Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Now we turn to this week's biz page in the Triangle Business Journal, and under the heading of Decisions Ahead comes the article, Dix Park Leaders Confident Before Key City Council Vote. Two leaders of the push for the Dorothea Dix Park are confident as a critical vote looms. After that comes the hard part, how to fund the ambitious plans. On February 19th, the Raleigh City Council will review the plan developed by Michael Van Valkenburg Associates of Brooklyn, New York, Jim Goodman, CEO of Capital Broadcasting Company, and Sean Malone, President and CEO of the Dorothea Dix Park Conservancy, see broad support for the park. Goodman says he believes the vote will be unanimous. If approved, the concepts would develop into specific plans with funding from public and private sources. The plan divides a campus into six zones, including the ridge with a hospital dating to 1856. It's a beautiful venue, and there are all kinds of ideas about what to do within the hospital, Goodman says, but everybody agrees that the historic hospital is the main thing. How the park is funded will be determined. Goodman says future operating budgets have gotten more discussion than any part of the plan. Options include a hotel, restaurants, rentals, and an amphitheater. Just like any project, you have capital costs to build, and you also have future operating budgets, Goodman says. We have to be thinking about both of those. And under the heading of That's the Spirit comes the article, Local Gin is Big Winner. Durham Distillery has yet another award to hang high. The distillery's Conniption Gin won the best in the United States under the Navy Strength category at the World Gin Awards. This is among the highest honors we could hope to attain, says Durham Distillery President and CEO Melissa Katrinchik, who founded the distillery with head distiller Lee Katrinchik. The distillery's American Dry Gin received a silver in the Contemporary Style Gin category this year as well. Conniption now has a shot at an international title as it will compete against countries from around the world for the World Gin Awards Best Award for the Navy Strength category. And under the heading of Ratings War comes the article, State of the Union Struggles Against State Carolina. Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi don't agree on much, but they did agree to hold the State of the Union on February the 5th. They should have checked their basketball schedules. That put the president's speech up against another big rivalry, the men's basketball game between NC State University and UNC Chapel Hill. The game started at 8 p.m. and the speech at 9. WRAL moved the basketball game to its sister station, Fox 50, so it could carry the NBC coverage of Trump's speech. And the overall night ratings show the power of basketball in this market. Fox 50 had an overnight household rating of a whopping 11.5. By comparison, the three network telecasts of State of the Union in this market, that's NBC, CBS, and ABC, combined to draw an 11.5. And under the heading of Soda Wars comes the article, Coke or Pepsi? RDU may decide. Coke or Pepsi diehards, pay attention. Raleigh-Durham International Airport is considering creative ways to pay for its massive revamp. And as stadiums and universities have done in the past, it's considering inking an exclusivity contract with a beverage manufacturer. According to a presentation to the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority Board of Directors by a representative from Enliven, a firm that negotiates beverage deals, these types of contracts, dubbed beverage pour agreements, are already in play at the airport. While some of RDU's restaurant vendors exclusively offer either Coca-Cola or Pepsi products, the airport itself doesn't have an exclusivity policy. And under the heading of Money Back comes the article, Solar Energy Rebates Can Add Up at Duke Energy. Within 2 hours on January 2nd, Duke Energy's solar rebate for homeowners was subscribed, as the company received 1,150 applications. But there's still a significant amount of money waiting for nonprofits, just 7 of which sent in applications for those rebates. According to the company, Duke Energy Progress alone has set aside 2,500 kilowatts alternating current per year. And those rebates at about 75 cents per watt, equating to nearly $1.9 million a year, have gone largely unclaimed. As much of the available capacity was unused in 2018, it rolled over, making a total pot of more than 4,500 kilowatts AC. It's something some churches in the Triangle are starting to figure out. Pilgrim United Church of Christ in Durham was one of the first to sign on for the North Carolina Duke Energy solar rebate last year. Its net metered system allows the church to use the energy it generates with excess sent back to the grid, and it was eligible for a $32,000 rebate. And finally, on the biz page in this week's Triangle Business Journal, under the heading of Interesting Move, why this Raleigh mission was sold to a nonprofit. The proud new owner of an 18,400-square-foot mansion north of Raleigh is a small nonprofit in Greensboro that helps feed hungry seniors. But the estate isn't going to house the homeless or serve as a soup kitchen. Instead, its sale is supposed to raise funds for the nonprofit called Food Assistance, Inc., while generating tax breaks for the former owner. Tech entrepreneur Rich Lee sold his home to the nonprofit for $3.5 million with the help of a Florida real estate brokerage firm and a special provision in the tax code. Lee was contacted by Wellfont of Tampa, Florida, which facilitated the sale and has partnered with Food Assistance on several similar transactions in recent years. In these types of transactions, known as 170 bargain sales, named after a section of the tax code, the seller parts with the home for less than market value, but recoups tax breaks equal to the difference between the sales price and appraised value of the home. Lee wouldn't reveal exactly what that amounted to for his home sale. He previously listed the home on the market for $9.5 million in May, although the tax value as assessed by the county is just under $5.5 million. Property records show he bought the estate for $2.9 million in 2010. Once the nonprofit and the real estate brokerage firm buy the home, with help from lenders, they seek to sell it for a larger sum. The difference between the purchase price and the sales price is shared between the two. As long as a home sells for more than $3.5 million, which I think is going to happen, they have a really good opportunity to do some good things in the community, Lee says, adding that he didn't know about the nonprofit before deciding to sell his home for a tax break. Now we turn to the technology and utilities page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and we find the heading Gas Line. The article is Dominion CEO Optimistic Pipeline Will Be Restarted. Despite regulatory holdups, the CEO of Dominion Energy is confident the now $7.5 billion Atlantic Coast Pipeline will restart full construction in the third quarter, with the Lumberton end of the project on track to enter commercial service by the end of 2020, with the balance of the project being delivered in early 2021. In an earnings call February the 1st, CEO Tom Farrell told analysts he remains highly confident in the successful and timely resolution of all outstanding permit issues, as well as the ultimate completion of the entire project. The Department of Justice will weigh in before February 11th, and, as he told analysts, you can always appeal to the Supreme Court. On December the 13th, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals vacated a stay by the U.S. Forest Service that allowed the pipeline to cross two national forests and the Appalachian Trail. He said Dominion believes issues with permits required to cross the Appalachian Trail should be resolved no later than this fall. Calling the project critical for customers, as well as for the transition away from coal-fired power generation, he said state regulatory commissions and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission have all attested independently to the need for this project. And he said that rules have been followed, coupled with years of painstaking surveying, data collection, and scientific analysis. And also on the technology utilities page comes the article, Wake Forest Turns to Ting for Fiber Service. 4 years after cutting ties with a company that promised and then failed to deliver fiber internet service, Wake Forest hopes a Canadian company can at long last bring lightning-fast connection speeds throughout the town. Ting Internet, a subsidiary of Canada's Tucows that has already activated fiber lines in Holly Springs and Fuca-Varina, announced plans on February the 5th to expand its high-speed internet to Wake Forest. And this time, it's sticking, CEO Elliot Noss says in an interview. We have no contingencies, he said. We're not relying on anybody else for the capital to do this. We're not relying on anybody else for the operating expense to do this. Our track record, not just in the fiber business, but in the internet business, more broadly over the last 25 years, is one of methodical execution and great customer experience that anybody that's worried should go find a friend in Holly Springs and ask how it's going. In 2014, Shelby-based RST Fiber said fiber would be in Wake Forest in a matter of months. While trenches were dug and plans were submitted, no connections ever materialized, despite 2,500 signups in Wake Forest. In 2015, the town announced that, following a frustrating series of starts and stops, it was breaking all ties with RST Fiber. As RST dealt with its own legal troubles, the town issued requests for proposals. When Ting announced plans in 2015 to make its Triangle debut in Holly Springs, its executives were vocal about being open to exploring other Triangle towns. It launched its Holly Springs service in early 2017 and made expansion plans to Fuca-Varina last year. Bill Crabtree, Wake Forest's communications director, points to Ting's presence in both Holly Springs and Fuca-Varina as validation that the town is unlikely to have a repeat of RST's broken promises. Now, a couple of other sidebar items on the technology and utilities page from this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Kinston Facility comes the article, Spirit AeroSystems CEO calls $10 million settlement fair. 2 years of litigation resulted in a fair settlement of $10 million, according to Dim Gentile, CEO of Spirit AeroSystems, commenting on the situation since the aerospace manufacturer settled with insurers over losses it blamed on 2016's Hurricane Matthew. To meet Airbus orders at its Kinston factory following storm delays, the company had to expedite its shipping, sending the massive fuselages by plane to France. Over the course of a year, it meant about $32 million in costs, he told investors during a recent earnings call. And so, combined with some relief that Airbus gave us on other costs, we felt like we had. It was a fair settlement, and we took it. Gentile took analysts of the $10 million figure. The company, which builds fuselages for Airbus jets at its North Carolina facility, has not built into its metrics the scenario of another hurricane impacting operations in Kinston in 2019, he said. We'll address it if it occurs. And finally, from the technology utilities page, under the heading of He Said It, comes the article, Cree CEO explains why company is well positioned. On a recent call with analysts, Cree CEO Greg Lowe was asked how long it will be before a competitor can replicate what Cree is doing in the wafer business for silicon carbide. So it's difficult. It's not like silicon growing silicon crystals, he responded. It's a lot more finicky, if you will. And so we believe that we have a substantial amount of know-how, intellectual property, and experience that's going to allow us to continue to have a really unique position in this marketplace. That all being said, we worry every single day about competitors coming in, and so what we're focused on is increasing the adoption and driving costs through scale, manufacturing efficiencies, yield improvements, and so forth. Next, we turn to the real estate page for the Triangle Business Journal, and under the heading of Changing Times comes the article, Triangle Malls Look for Ways to Reinvent Themselves. The past few months have been a brutal stretch for the Triangle's major malls. Department stores that have anchored the region's busiest enclosed shopping centers have shut their doors. Mall owners have struggled to maintain the debt tied to their properties. In the past 2 months, Northgate Mall in Durham and Cary Town Center at Cary have sold in the midst of financial difficulties, and Triangle Town Center has defaulted on its loans. But retail experts say the tumult is a result of the changes in the way people shop, which could lead to revitalization. Retail is something that is constantly in transition in terms of type of product, says Jeff Nimmer, broker with the Shopping Center Group. Just as consumers once transitioned from Main Street shops to major malls and shopping complexes, Nimmer says shoppers are altering their behavior once again. Each of the three malls struggle to keep up with pressures from e-commerce. When shoppers today visit a brick-and-mortar shopping complex, they're looking for an experience, says Hunter Stewart, broker at Lee & Associates. It's becoming an outing, he says. That means malls have to be more than just a place that shoppers go to buy a single product and then leave. Many shopping complexes could be looking to places such as Cameron Village and North Hills, which have created vibrant street front shops and entertainment that pull in shoppers. The retail that is surviving and thriving are the shops offering products that consumers are hesitant to buy online. I think the specialty world of retail seems to be coming on pretty strong, whether that's clothing, shoes, or furniture, Stewart says. Now, continuing with the real estate page comes the article under the heading of Commercial Space, Developer Plans Office Buildings Near PNC Arena. A Raleigh developer has drafted plans to bring two new office buildings to West Raleigh by expanding the existing Palisades office campus on Trinity Road, down the street from PNC Arena. Keystone Corporation has submitted plans to the city to build 4- and 5-story office buildings on a triangular slice of land the firm acquired last year. The project would more than double the amount of office space in the existing Palisades complex. Two existing buildings across the street, Palisades 1 and 2, total 161,480 square feet. Keystone Corporation bought the buildings last summer for $32.43 million. The company's new project will total about 210,000 square feet of rentable space, Keystone Vice President Michael Blunt says. While the office market has been booming in denser nodes around the city, he says there's still strong demand for suburban office development, where access is simpler. We still believe in the ease of access and ability to park these buildings, Blunt says. And the article, Incentives Spark New 53-Acre Mixed-Use Plan in Johnston County. A sprawling mixed-use development outside of Selma could soon begin gaining steam, thanks to incentives approved by the Johnston County Commissioners. Elected officials have agreed to a package that would provide annual grants to the developers of the East Field project in exchange for meeting specific investment and timeline targets. The development plans include a wide mix of commercial and residential buildings, rising on 353 acres next to Selma, although the incentive package pertains only to the project's industrial development. Adventure Development, based in Selma, is the firm behind the project. The first phase of the development involves building a 100,000-square-foot warehouse facility aimed at attracting companies to the property. Once that's built, it's going to take off, says Chris Johnson, Johnston County Economic Development Director. The first milestone for the incentive package requires the developers to invest $40 million by 2023. After that threshold, the developer will receive a grant of more than $218,000 annually for 7 years. The build-out includes plans for a business park, medical office facilities, single-family homes, apartments, retail shops, hotels, and a senior living community. Overall investment in the project is expected to reach $287.5 million. And finally, on the real estate page, under the heading of Granny Flats, comes the article, Raleigh City Council Weighs Dwelling Rules. Raleigh City Council has ended years of debate over how to regulate accessory dwelling units in the city. Well, almost. A majority of the City Council voted February the 5th in favor of new regulations that would allow homeowners to apply for special zoning overlays in which accessory dwelling units, also known as ADUs or granny flats, would be permitted. A technicality has forced another vote on the regulations, but approval seems likely. The new policy, which requires homeowners to get permission from neighbors to create a special zoning overlay for ADUs, has been years in the making. But it doesn't have the support of people who have been advocating for ADUs. Proponents have advocated that property owners should be able to build an additional unit by right, meaning without requiring any kind of special approval. Advocates view ADUs as a boon for affordable housing, but they say the policy backed by the City Council is too complicated for homeowners to navigate. How can an average citizen who doesn't keep paid to keep an eye on what the City of Raleigh is doing possibly understand the steps they have to follow? Raleigh Regional Association of Realtors Government Affairs Director Andrew Blackburn asked during public comment. Next, we turn to the Life Sciences and Education page of this week's TBJ. And under the heading of Rising comes the article, NCSU and UNC Chapel Hill Endowments Post Double-Digit Gains. University endowments in the Triangle continued to grow in 2018, though signs point toward a slowdown, especially after some of these college endowments stop adding dollars following their fundraising drives. In terms of percentage growth in endowment, NC State University bested UNC Chapel Hill and Duke University, posting a 15.2% gain in 2018 from $1.12 billion to $1.29 billion, according to data supplied by the National Association of College and University Business Owners, and TIAA. Between 2016 and 2017, the Wolfpack endowment grew 12.4%. UNC Chapel Hill posted a 13.4% gain last year from $3 billion to $3.4 billion. A year ago, that stood at 4.8%. Duke University posted a 7.8% gain in 2018, down from the 15.2% growth registered just a year ago. Duke's endowment eclipses $8.5 billion. And under the heading of New Leader comes the article, UNC Chapel Hill Names Interim Chancellor. Kevin Guskowitz, a nationally recognized sports concussion researcher and dean of the UNC Chapel Hill College of Arts and Sciences, will serve as the interim chancellor of UNC. Guskowitz replaces Carol Folt. After widespread and helpful input, I strongly believe Kevin is the best person to lead UNC Chapel Hill, Dr. William Roper, the interim president of the UNC system, said February the 6th. Kevin is an outstanding researcher, innovator, and strategic thinker, and I look forward to working with him over the coming months. Folt served her last day on January the 31st. The same day, Roper said he was considering a short list of potential interim candidates. In naming Guskowitz, Roper said Carolina needs someone who knows the institution, knows the state, and is ready to drive the university forward. Kevin is that leader. Guskowitz has served as dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UNC since January of 2016, overseeing the largest academic institution at the school. The university has more than 17,000 undergraduate students and 2,400 graduate students, and it encompasses more than 70 academic departments, curricula, programs, centers, and institutes. It's an honor to be asked to lead the nation's first public university into the next chapter of its storied history, Guskowitz said. When I became dean, I pledged to be strategic, bold, and student-focused, and those imperatives will continue to guide me in this role. I'm excited and energized by the possibility and promise of the things that Carolina community can accomplish together. And under the heading of creating graduates, comes the article, Wake Tech Initiative Will Spread to All NC Community Colleges. A tool that resulted in a dramatic spike in graduation rates at Wake Technical Community College will be implemented at all of North Carolina's 58 community colleges. The NC Community College System recently announced a $554,000 gift from the Belk Endowment, which will help expand Wake Tech's Finish First initiative. It allows students and their advisors to chart the most efficient path to successful completion of degrees, diplomas, and certificates. It also might find students who may not have realized they already earned a credential on their way to an associate's degree so that the credential may be awarded. The tool was first implemented at Wake Tech for the 2016-17 academic year and resulted in more than 8,200 degrees, diplomas, and certificates being awarded at the college, almost twice as many as the year before. Also on this week's Life Sciences page, in the heading C-Suite Shuffle, comes the article, Novan Promotes Stafford as NASDAQ Deadline Looms. As Novan fights to avoid being delisted from NASDAQ, the company has reshaped the executive team by bringing in new personnel and locking in the services of critical managers. Paula Brown Stafford, the company's former chief development officer, is now president and chief operating officer, a newly created role in early January. She replaces Nathan Stasko, who has stepped down as president and from his role on the board of directors. According to securities documents, Stafford will receive $450,000 in salary and is eligible for a performance bonus equal to 50% of her salary. In the event of Stafford's termination of employment by the company without cause or by Stafford for good reason, not due to a change in control, then she's entitled to receive payments of equal to 12 months of her salary, calculated based on 100% of objective achievements. As of January the 31st, Jeff Hunter, the company's executive vice president and chief business officer, resigned from the company. Hunter's exit package includes a provision keeping him on as a consultant for two ongoing corporate development projects through September 30. Hunter will receive $61,250 upon achievement of unspecified target objectives associated with those projects and will be paid $250 an hour. The company received notice from NASDAQ in January that if it could not raise its company value back over the $50 million threshold by July 15th, it would be delisted. Though not specified, those ongoing corporate development projects could hint at the company's intention to find a way to fill some critical pieces with experienced executives who can drive the value up. Additionally, the company appointed John Gray to serve as the company's principal financial officer. Gray formerly served as the company's senior director of finance and corporate controller since May of 2018. The company also announced the hiring of David Herbert to its clinical development team as senior director of biometrics. Herbert joins Novan from UCB Biosciences, where he most recently served as head of global statistical sciences. Now turning to the Around the State page, under the heading of Bank Merger comes BB&T and SunTrust combine in $66 billion deal, new headquarters to be in Charlotte. Winston-Salem-based BB&T Corporation and SunTrust Banks Incorporated out of Atlanta announced on February the 7th that they are merging in an all-out stock deal valued at around $66 billion. The merged bank will have a new name, and the corporate headquarters will be based in Charlotte. The new entity will be among the top 10 banks in the U.S. by assets and deposits. Kelly King, chairman and CEO of BB&T, will keep his role in the combined company until September the 12th, 2021, when he will continue as executive chairman until March 12, 2022. King will then serve on the board of directors through 2023. Bill Rogers, chairman and CEO of SunTrust, will serve as president and CEO of the combined company until September 12, 2021, at which point he will take over as the sole CEO. Rogers will take over as sole chairman on March 12, 2022. It's an extraordinarily attractive financial proposition that provides the scale needed to compete and win in the rapidly evolving world of financial services, King said in a statement. The combined BB&T SunTrust will have roughly $442 billion in assets, $301 billion in loans, and $324 billion in deposits, making it the sixth largest U.S. bank based on assets and deposits. SunTrust employs 23,800 people, while BB&T employs about 35,850. It will serve more than 10 million households in the United States, with leading market share in many of the most attractive high-growth markets in the country. BB&T ranks third among North Carolina's largest banks in terms of deposits, with about $52.7 billion in deposits and 14.4% of the state's market share. In the Raleigh area, SunTrust is ranked sixth in terms of deposits, with 22 offices with a 4.9% market share. BB&T is ranked second in the Raleigh area with 36 offices at a 15.3% market share as of June 30th last year, according to federal regulators. In the Durham-Chapel Hill Metro, SunTrust is ranked third with 19 offices and 14.6% market share. BB&T is ranked fifth in the Durham-Chapel Hill Metro with 13 offices and an 8.6% market share. The two banks say, along with the headquarters in Charlotte, the new entity will establish a community banking center in Winston-Salem and a wholesale banking hub in Atlanta. Rogers says the combined institution will provide new opportunities for technological capabilities. Rogers grew up in Durham and graduated from UNC Chapel Hill. Our shared culture embraces the disruption of technology, and we will take this innovative mindset to expand our leadership in the next chapter of these historic brands, Rogers said in a statement. I have tremendous respect for Kelly, his leadership team, and his BB&T associates. We will leverage our respective strengths as we focus together on the future. The deal has been approved by the boards of both banks. It's expected to close in the fourth quarter. Now we turn to this week's cover story, the title of which is Tales from the Crypto Investor. In the most recent episode of the popular television show Madam Secretary, a scene plays out in the house of the fictitious Secretary of State Elizabeth McCord, played by Tia Leone, where her son Jason admits he's being entrepreneurial and is running a business from home. SpectraCoin, Jason announces. It's a cryptocurrency, and I'm mining it, so I networked the house's iPads, laptops, and desktops. When Jason's parents objected to such a move, he simply replied, "Look, I made $3,000 this month." Before the episode ended, viewers also watched Jason admit that he lost all the money and needs a real job. The understanding and popularity of blockchain technology and cryptocurrency may not be currently playing out in the living rooms of households as depicted in the McCord household, but don't tell that to the 55-year-old fast-talking Mark Yusko. The CEO of Chapel Hill-based Morgan Creek Capital Management, which once grew to an investment house with $6.5 billion in assets under management in 2013, is trying to turn the investment world upside down. If you think about the world of assets now, there's stocks, there's bonds, there's currency, there's commodities, Yusko says with a serious face. And someday, it's all going digital, he insists. There will be digital shares of stock. There will be digital bonds, digital currencies, he says. And that's where Yusko's bet on blockchain and cryptocurrency come in. In the digital age, people are going to invest differently, he explains. I mean, Coinbase, which is the largest exchange, has more accounts now than Charles Schwab. Today, Morgan Creek has about $1 billion under management. Yusko's Morgan Creek Global Equity Long Short Institutional Fund reported a 2.2% return in 2018, even when the MSCI World Index, a broad global equity index representing large and mid-capped equity performance, dipped 8.7%. To many, Yusko's ambitious journey to shepherd his investors to a place fraught with risks and volatile sentiments may seem too dangerous. But to Yusko, it's simply an evolution from his days of trading stocks and bonds. When working at the University of Notre Dame as the school's chief investment officer, he once made a $500,000 bet on Google. We took out $200 million, he says. If Yusko's right about blockchain technology, that Google return on investment for Notre Dame may look like a utilitarian stock pick. But if he's wrong, it can mean a colossal failure for a man considered by many to be one of the smartest minds in investing. Yusko insists Morgan Creek is the same it's always been, investing in stocks and commodities. It's just added digital assets and strategies to the mix, versatility that could one day be a necessity. Mark has the ability to see around corners sometimes, says Greg Bolin, founder of Union Grove Partners. That's a pretty valuable tool. Timing isn't always perfect, but I think he does a really good job of calling trends. Yusko is a negotiator, and he's not afraid to go against the traditional even when it comes to decor. Take the sleek wooden tables in his rustic hunting lodge-like Chapel Hill office, custom-made with laser-cut outlines of the nations he's gone in to invest and won from over the years, such as Brazil, Russia, India, and China. When he tried to keep it local and ordered the tables from North Carolina carpenter, he was quoted tens of thousands of dollars for each one. So, forever frugal, he went to China instead, and 4 months later, five big boxes arrived. And we got our tables. $25,000 for all five, says Yusko. That's how he invests, too. Looking for a deal, even when he has to go outside of what's comfortable for most. Yusko describes his life as a series of happy accidents. At first, he wanted to be an architect, to make a dent on the skyline. College whittled away that goal, however, and when his alma mater, Notre Dame, called with news that its investment head had retired, he jumped at the chance to take on the challenge. Fresh out of MBA school at the University of Chicago, he admits it wasn't really about the job. I wanted to be at Notre Dame more than I wanted to pick stocks and bonds, he says. But it wasn't long before he realized the game was addictive. I realized asset allocation was what it was all about. It wasn't, do you buy IBM or Cisco? It was, do you want equities at all? Do you own bonds? Do you own real estate? Recruited by the late UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Michael Hooker, Yusko left Notre Dame in 1998 to head up the endowment office at UNC. There, from 1998 to 2004, he led the UNC management company. Even today, he grins at the memories of Tar Heel's successes. It was Yusko who reconfigured UNC's asset allocation. He pushed for the creation of a management company that could handle both UNC Chapel Hill's investments and those of other UNC system schools. And it worked. We didn't lose any money from 2000 to 2002, when the average endowment lost 25%, he says. That's when it happened. Some people called me and said, we want you to come manage family money. At first, he balked. I worked for big, stodgy institutions my whole life, he says. I'm very safe. And the safety started to feel heavy. And differences of opinion with the UNC Management Company Board over the pace of change in Chapel Hill clinched his decision to leave. Morgan Creek began, initially with just a handful of wealthy families. In 2 years, it was already eyeing overseas opportunities, pulling together $50 million to invest in hedge funds, working in emerging markets such as India, China, and Russia. And its founder was earning a reputation, both for his investment acumen and his monologues. Mark has no shortage of opinions, Boland says. He's a smart guy, able to take a lot of complex issues and boil them down very quickly. His speeches were described by some as evangelical. Those he used to work with described talent on the stump, comparing him to both Michael Scott from The Office and the Reverend Billy Graham. Yusko shakes it off, just as he shakes off his failures, of which, his critics remind, there have been many. When you're successful, you don't learn anything, Yusko says. When we fail, we learn a ton. 2008, described by some as disastrous for Morgan Creek, brought numerous lessons, thanks in part to a Texas fund he oversaw through an agreement with Salient Partners. In 2013, he was dropped as a chief investment officer of the $3.5 billion endowment fund, a private investment vehicle offered by Houston-based Salient Partners. At the time, Salient's CEO John Blaisdell said in securities filings that a meaningful number of investors in the fund have lost confidence in Mr. Yusko's ability to deliver results consistent with expectations. Some industry watchers have said they're surprised he's still in business, something Yusko shrugs off. Yusko says he's learned from his mistakes, pointing to how the firm worked its way up from the bottom. It's his ability to pivot, to diversify, that saved Morgan Creek, he says, and crypto could be another move along that same vein. Yusko's journey toward crypto began 5 years ago. That's when Dan Moorhead, a friend of mine, began Pantera Ventures in California, a venture fund focused around Bitcoin. It was the first of my bad decisions in crypto, Yusko says. I'd kind of heard about it, but I didn't know that much about it, he says. I'm a picks and shovels kind of guy. If you're going to be in the gold rush, sell the picks and shovels. Sell the blue jeans. Yesko followed his instincts in 2013, investing in a fund he described as the picks and shovels fund, not the Bitcoin fund. While his fund increased in the single digits, the Bitcoin fund was up 120 times, he recalls. It was one of those haunting decisions he couldn't get out of his head. In his next quarterly report, a 60-page document, he wrote a single paragraph calling Bitcoin a special opportunity. And people remembered. We actually had clients say, "Stop talking about this stupid stuff or we'll fire you," he says. People were really like, "This is not real stuff. It's going to zero. And serious firms shouldn't talk about crypto." But Yesko kept talking. A lot. Before he invested heavily, he did a lot of tweeting and a lot more digging, he says. And over time, the message resonated with progressive clients. We said, "We should think about a 1% position in cryptocurrency as a diversifying asset for a traditional portfolio," he says. Not everyone is on board. Yesko says he hears from his critics often. Despite the doubters, no one followed through on that threat of pulling money from his funds, he says. And it's hardly the first time he's deflected their ire. When Morgan Creek began in 2004, it was hardly viewed as traditional, Yesko recalls. It was a product of his maverick endowment mindset, honed for more than a decade of leadership roles at funds for universities. When he left UNC to start Morgan Creek, the goal was to bring that endowment model outside of the university system, he says. And most people were like, "Hedge funds? That's where all the bad people are. That's where all the shady characters are," he says. "We created Morgan Creek to say hedge funds aren't scary." Morgan Creek was different, making early bets on deals in areas most finance professionals at the time considered toxic, such as mortgage markets and various asset-backed securities. In 2008, as the recession was taking hold, Morgan Creek tried to weasel into an investing advantage in the credit crisis and the ensuing sell-off of credit-related securities. It made several unconventional moves, such as a $200 million Cayman Islands-based offshore dislocation fund in 2008. Yesko believes he's created a fiscal infrastructure around blockchain that will make him successful. But Eric Geisels, a professor of economics at UNC Kenan Flagler, says it's not that simple. Since it's early in crypto technologies, there are a lot of players toying in the arena. It's not clear yet which ones are the good ones and which ones are not, which ones are the promising ones and which ones are not. So there are a lot of things that we really don't know much about, he says with a caveat. In fairness, you could say that about a lot of internet companies back in the 1990s when people were investing without knowing which company would be Google. But the crypto space, and Bitcoin in particular, is a level of volatility that's hard for even the seasoned investor to predict, Geisels says. It's not so clear to what extent does it behave differently from equities and bonds, he says. It does behave differently, and we don't have enough data on it yet to have a very good picture. From a pure asset allocation point of view, it's still too hard to figure that out. And maybe that's why Yesko wants to jump, to bet on the uncertainty. We formed Morgan Creek to help people embrace and integrate alternative investments into their investment portfolio, he says. But now, everybody has hedge funds. They're commonplace. But Yesko says an explosion in blockchain technology in particular is coming between now and 2024, and it's not going to wait on all the risks to alleviate. It's part of the transition from analog to digital, he says. He blames circumstance for the phenomena, saying that what has happened in the global financial crisis caused a generation to lose trust in traditional financial institutions. It's that generation that's further influenced this direction. Specifically, millennial investor Anthony Pompliano, a serial entrepreneur who founded Full Tilt Capital in Raleigh. The pair met through a mutual investment in Lyft, and within months, Yesko was following his tweets. "Everything he tweeted, I was liking," Yesko says. "It was like talking to myself. I joke a younger, better-looking version of myself, and I said, I've got to meet this guy." Through Pompliano, Yusko met Full Tilt co-founder Justin Williams. And following multiple conversations, Morgan Creek acquired Full Tilt. Williams says it was a natural combination. Our fund aligned itself very well with what Mark was thinking, he said. Today, both Pompliano and Williams are partners in Morgan Creek, and according to Yusko, they're driving the new digital arms strategy. We're not investing in ICOs, Pompliano says, referring to controversial initial coin offerings, which can run into regulatory issues when unregistered securities are involved. What we're doing is investing in real assets, equity, debt, and real estate, where the transaction is done via the blockchain, because we believe blockchain transactions to be more efficient, and where the financial industry is ultimately going. Crypto and blockchain are the future of computing, Yusko says, and he's hardly alone, as major firms from IBM to Aetna are exploring blockchain's application. That's as, in the case of Big Blue, it's tightening spending in its legacy businesses, hardware areas that sustain the company for decades. Every investment's a risk, but I think there's a bigger risk in not doing this, Bill LaFontaine, general manager of the intellectual property at IBM, said recently of blockchain. It's just an essential thing given how fast economies are growing. Morgan Creek closed its first crypto-related fund, the $17 million Morgan Creek Blockchain Opportunities Fund, in 2018, a venture capital vehicle investing in companies. Yusko describes as the picks and shovels of the industry, the exchanges, protocols, and software tools, the things we need to go from the analog age to the digital age. If Yusko and his team had their way, Morgan Creek's Bitwise Digital Asset Index Fund, modeled after the S&P 500, would become the S&P of crypto. But first, the campaign to distress investors about blockchain and cryptocurrency must start and succeed. For that, Yusko often hits the national business television news networks such as CNBC and Bloomberg. But his messaging is far more direct. On Twitter, "It's my name," he says. "I'm not hiding behind the egg. I have this thing, hashtag ignore the fund fear. Uncertainty, doubt, you just ignore the bad people." So the article also contains a chart of the top five cryptocurrencies by market capitalization. And I'll just read the names of the cryptocurrency and their market caps. Bitcoin with $60.5 billion, Ethereum with $11.1 billion, XRP with $11.9 billion, Bitcoin Cash with $2.1 billion, and EOS with $2.2 billion. If you're a frequent listener to Triangle Business Journal, you know that following the cover story, we usually have the executive voice. And such is the case today, and the executive voice this week belongs to Kerry Painter. Kerry Painter is in charge of the Raleigh Convention Center, and the article talks about is the Q&A with Painter about the Raleigh Convention Center. Former director Doug Grissom was demoted last year after being put on administrative leave. Kerry Painter has stepped in, bringing more than three decades of experience in managing similar facilities, most recently the Cox Business Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So here's the Q&A. "What was your first job out of college?" "I worked my way through college, so I was doing class assignments while working at the Fox Theater in Detroit, managing ushers and handling audience issues." "So how'd you get in the business of overseeing convention centers?" "I originally started at Kobo and Joe Louis Arena as a security person in Detroit. The first day I bodyguarded Prince, which was pretty amazing. He was smaller than me, so I guess if something happened and I stood in front of him, he'd be safe. I moved on to theaters and a baseball stadium and even spent a season touring with David Copperfield before I finally landed in a convention center. Shortly after I adopted my son, I decided to stay in convention centers to be best able to balance single motherhood and a career. I love working in convention centers. Their flexibility and variety every day suit me well." "What was your perception of Raleigh before moving here?" "My perception was that it would be quite southern in culture, which just turned out to be true. People just seem kinder, walking up and talking to me in random places, and the food is very Southern. I must admit, I'm not convinced yet I'm going to be a biscuit girl, but I'm willing to take on the challenge just to be sure. I'd always imagined the Research Triangle as a place of brilliance and innovation, and I assume with the universities here, they would bring a lot of innovative minds. So far, it's been really fun to hear about all the obscure things being worked on or developed here. And, of course, outsiders think it's pretty cool that Raleigh is near the birthplace of Fortnite. So what lessons are you bringing from Tulsa? In Tulsa, our complex consisted of an arena, convention center, and several inside-outside self-produced events, so I became pretty well-versed with balancing more than one facility and helping to leverage the relationship and sources for the greatest collaboration and efficiencies. What's the biggest change for the Raleigh Convention Center? I'm really excited about the conversations around optimizing the spaces we already have to attain the most possible business, which creates economic impact, and then ultimately leads the needed future expansion. Is expanding the convention center on your radar? It is, I can say. Having seen the studies and potential business we want to go after for Raleigh, expansion is definitely on the radar. So what's been your favorite non-work-related part of living in Raleigh? I've always abided by one rule when I relocate. Do everything there is to see and do within the first year. Just let yourself be a full-on tourist. Once you live somewhere for a while, you stop appreciating the amazing things that make your town fantastic. I'm a book lover, so I want to see the animated book bot at NC State's Hunt Library, the North Carolina Museum of Art, and also the State Farmers Market. I've also targeted the famous Howling Cow ice cream, and I hear I must get a handbag from Stitch. So what keeps you up at night? Security, and the fact that everyone who comes through our doors is our responsibility to keep safe. Finally, what books are on your nightstand? Before I left Tulsa, I had established a workbook club of sorts to study and implement ways to apply the ideas and theories from a book called The Power of Moments into our daily operation. Crazy enough, it turns out the book's written by a professor right here at Duke University, Dan Heath. So now, I have this idea that I'm going to lure him to come speak to our staff and start the project all over again. Maybe he'll read this article and call me. Now we turn to the viewpoint page of this week's TBJ, and under the editor's notebook comes the article, EDPNC Needs Careful Evaluation. In 2014, under former Governor Pat McCrory, the economic development efforts of the state of North Carolina were moved from the Department of Commerce to a new nonprofit agency called the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina. After more than 4 years, the effectiveness of this agency is under scrutiny. A legislative report released a few days ago concludes that the formation of the EDPNC, a 501c3 entity, has presented some communication challenges with the State Commerce Department, the agency that was stripped of taking the lead to recruit jobs and investments. That resulted in EDPNC entering into a contract with Commerce to become the sales and marketing arm for business development and recruitment, international trade, and travel and tourism. Other than EDPNC and Commerce not communicating effectively, the report also recommended EDPNC raise $2 million every year in private funds. That would allow fewer taxpayer dollars to be siphoned to the agency. Currently, almost 90% of EDPNC's budget is funded by North Carolinians. So the big question is, what will legislators do later this year when it comes time to renew or cancel the contract? Will they shut down the agency? Will they restructure some of the EDPNC's functions? Or will they move additional responsibilities to EDPNC and strip Commerce some more? That's where politics could spread its wings on Jones Street. With a Democratic Governor, Roy Cooper, and Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland, it's hard to believe the North Carolina legislature is going to give Cooper and Copeland more authority with business recruitment strategy. With elections less than 2 years away, Senate Leader Phil Berger and House Speaker Tim Moore, both Republicans, are not going to sit on the sidelines watching Cooper and Copeland sit beside CEOs and county leaders and take credit for every economic development project. Being the governor and a commerce secretary, with or without the EDPNC, Cooper and Copeland still get to be front and center at press conferences. Still, if legislators decided to move the business development and recruitment functions to Commerce, that would be shocking. A more plausible scenario would be to strip ADPNC of some of the functions. Ask agency leader Chris Chung to develop a better communication strategy with Copeland's team and raise more dollars for the private sector. Chung, acknowledging there are communication challenges, already has indicated ADPNC needs to do a better job of working together with the state government. But he seems to be balking at the notion that the nonprofit agency needs to raise $2 million every year. In the past 4 years, ADPNC has raised about $4.6 million. The only donors that provided more than $50,000 between 2015 and 2018 were Duke Energy, Red Hat, MetLife, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Piedmont Natural Gas. Chung makes the point that his agency has to work with other economic development groups in the state that conduct their own fundraising by tapping into the private sector. And everyone's essentially going to the same well to raise that money. In other words, ADPNC will compete with the local chambers of commerce and regional eco-development groups for those dollars. While true, the argument's unlikely to fly with the legislators. In 2016, for example, 8 of the 12 states that use a similar nonprofit organizational structure for its economic development functions were solicited more private donations than ADPNC, according to the legislature report. Only Utah, Missouri, and New Mexico raised fewer dollars. The stakes are high for Chung. He has to find a way to work with commerce officials better and start devising a strategy to solicit private dollars and lower the state appropriations burden. In the end, if you're going to call yourself the leading economic development arm of the state, make sure you're spending your time and money doing just that. In 2017-18, ADPNC spent $21.1 million to run its operations. Only $3.4 million went toward business development, recruitment, and support. That's about 16% of the total expenditures. Currently, most of the money is geared to promote travel and tourism, more than 50%. This is an important issue for the state. Legislators need to weigh all the options very carefully. Well, that music means that we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long till next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, that phone number, 919-832-5138.